and welcome to a very special edition of the Fremantle Press podcast, which we're calling Love to Read Local Radio. Love to Read Local is an ostensibly week-long celebration of local literature that actually takes place over 10 days, from the 29th of May to the 7th of June, because there are simply too many wonderful West Australian writers and illustrators kicking around our state. As keen-eared listeners will no doubt have gathered, I'm not your usual host, Rebecca Higgy. My name is Alexander Thorpe, and I'm a newcomer to the Fremantle Press stable. My first historical mystery novel, Death Leaves the Station, will be released later this year. In the meantime, I've got plenty of local reading to catch up on and plenty to learn from those, like today's guest, who have already found success in their work. The guest in question is an internationally published best-selling author of six psychological suspense novels. She lives in Western Australia with her husband and daughters and is currently a doctoral candidate at Curtin University studying maternal relationships in dystopian fiction. Her five critically acclaimed novels are published by Simon & Schuster and include Come Back to Me, Beneath the Shadows, Shallow Breath, All That Is Lost Between Us, and The Hidden Hours. Her latest book is You Don't Know Me. Welcome, Sarah Foster.
Thank you, Alex. Good to be here.
Excellent. How are you holding up under the staying at home COVID situation?
Well, I would like to say that I'm not going crazy, but I think it's a day-by-day thing for me. Some days are better than others. I have two fairly young children at home, so, yeah, we are definitely up and down, but we're managing so far. What about you?
Yeah, not too bad. I haven't got the children situation, just the dog, mainly having to to adjust to doing everything online, but, you know, doing a lot better than we could be, so that's good.
Yeah,
good. So it's Love to Read Local Week, and you grew up in the UK and you moved to Perth as an adult. Do you feel like a local yet? What does Perth mean to you?
Well, I do feel like a local, actually. Perth means a lot to me because I came travelling here in 2002 and I loved the place so much. I came with my husband and we absolutely adored the place and the outdoor lifestyle. And so we moved here in 2004 and I've never suffered a day's homesickness. It's always felt very much like home. So I'm very happy to be adopted as a local. And I've spent the last 14 years trying to learn as much as I can about the place. About 16 years now, I'm losing track. Trying to learn as much as I can about the place and just really embed myself here because it does feel like the place I was meant to live.
Oh, that's excellent. That's really good to hear. I think the main thing to know is that if you're from north of the river, you can't go south of the river and vice versa. They're enemy states at war.
Yeah, I gather that. Are you south or north?
I'm south, yeah.
Oh, no. You see, we can never meet.
I know. That's why we're doing this remotely. It's just a coincidence that it's a COVID situation. So you have had a couple of books that come to Perth and, you know, several set in the eastern states as well, but a lot of them are set in the UK, obviously where you're from. Is that because, you know, that still feels like your home creatively, or do you, you know, just take it on a book-by-book basis? How does that work for you?
Well, I do take it on a book-by-book basis. So my first novel, Come Back to Me, was actually set between Perth and London, which was before I even moved to Perth. So that's quite nice, actually, that I've got that connection going on there. My second novel was set in a very small village in the North Yorkshire Moors, which is where my in-laws come from. And I just fell in love with the ghost stories and all the history and myths around the place. And I loved incorporating all that in the story. So those were very clear to me that I was going to set those two in the locations that I chose. Mm-hmm. But as I've gone on, I've felt more like I want to set things in Australia, and yet the UK calls me back. So the one I'm doing now is set in the UK. And it's interesting. I don't quite know why that is. I think maybe having grown up, you get immersed in that culture that you grow up in. So obviously, you feel very comfortable that you know all the kind of childhood stories, you know the political background, all the kind of things that you might not be as aware of here. So even though I feel like I've lived here for quite a long time, I still feel like I hark back to the UK quite a bit for my writing. But I am starting to mix it up a little bit as well. I do like to challenge myself.
Yeah, no, I find that. My wife's from the US and we've been living in Australia for a while and we often sort of get confused. Is that something you say or is that something I say? Am I picking up on your on your accent, or are you picking up on mine, things like that?
Absolutely, yeah.
So which crime writers actually inspired you to start writing and specifically to get into this genre? Is there anyone that you that you look up to in that area or that really got you started?
Well, I grew up reading Agatha Christie because my mum had a row of Agatha Christie books on her bookshelf. So
read compulsory. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I think Agatha Christie was my first staple. When I started working, I went to London, I started working in HarperCollins Publishers, and I worked in the fiction department there, which had a few great crime writers coming through. And at the time, I was very interested in reading police procedural crime. So I really enjoyed Val McDermid at that time. There was another guy writing called Boris Starling, who I thought was fantastic, who I don't think writes anymore, but he did really atmospheric crime set in London, and I absorbed all of his books. So that was the starting point. But then as I went further along in my reading, I kind of lost interest in the police procedurals as much and started to look more at the psychological thrillers. And then I found Nikki French, and that's a writing team, a husband and wife writing team. I just loved the way that they wrote. So I think that they have been my greatest inspiration for the kind of thing I like to do, because they always approach crimes in a little bit of a roundabout way. And it's often got a very psychological bent, and they're often very creative in their narrative structure as well. So one of the first ones I read of theirs was called Beneath the Skin. And that's told in three parts from three different narrators. And at the end of the first part, something really quite shocking happens that blew me away, that you could incorporate that into narrative. And I think they inspired me that you could play with narrative in that way and tell great crime stories. So it went on from there, really. And I love people like Sophie Hannestill, who, again, she tells crimes, but looking at it from a slightly different point of view. So I've gone that way too. And instead of always taking up the police procedural aspect of the case, even though there's often police involved in my stories, I like to look at it from different lenses, particularly family relationships as well, because I find that really fascinating. I'd actually throw that question back to you as well, Alex, because you are coming at crime from a very different, having looked at your book, which is fantastic.
Thank you.
I can tell that you're coming a very different way at the crime than I am. Obviously, it's historical to start with. It's quite literary. So who inspires you as well?
Just as you said, Agatha Christie is always there, is always a big one. But I sort of stayed in that area. I love people around that time, but I sort of moved into reading a lot more like Naomi Marsh was a big one, and probably Josephine Tay was a huge one. I found that she had this, the same sort of era and the same general style as Agatha Christie, but just like you were saying, she played with things a lot more and took plots in a direction that was not so expected, because obviously I think one of the things that's great about Agatha Christie is you sort of know what you're getting. you pick up an Agatha Christie book and you go, I'm going to read an Agatha Christie book, and you can kind of know half of what's going to happen already, but you still love it. And Josephine Tay, I find, sort of did that in a way, but then she had these really unusual twists, like like with The Daughter of Time, when the whole sort of thing is the protagonist in a hospital bed after he's fallen down a hole, and he's kind of trying to put together a historical mystery from documents that people bring him and things. So yeah, I really like that, taking that really sort of safe, familiar format, I suppose, and relishing it, but also maybe trying to see what you could do a little bit different with it.
I'm curious as well, have you read any Solari Gentil? She's a Australian author who writes historical crime.
I have. I actually didn't read her until after I had finished my book, because my editor said, as you pick up and goes, oh, this is really similar to Solari.
Yeah.
And I went, So I've actually read a couple of her books now, but only since finishing mine. So it's quite funny going to it, because there's a lot of stuff where I'm going, oh, I should have, there are political elements that I could have looked at, and obviously I wasn't around the 1920s. So it's a question of how much research you do and how much you bring into it from different areas. And what I was, I was quite astonished when I read it. I was like, oh, this is fantastic, exactly what I'm sort of looking for and exactly what I'm working with. Do you like her stuff as well?
I do. I love her stuff. I did an event with her a few years ago and I read one of her books then, and I thought it was absolutely brilliant and just such a unique take into crime again, just like we've been talking about. And when I read yours, it really reminded me of Solari as well. So, yeah, it was great. And that's why I wondered whether you'd read any of hers.
Yeah, no, I have. Yeah, that's great to hear. Thank you. You mentioned that you worked in publishing. before you actually started writing, what was one of the things that sort of struck you the most when you changed from, you know, from the one side to the other, I suppose, or when you sort of shifted that perspective?
Yeah, well, I was an editor before I was officially a novelist, although I was writing that whole time. So I don't know how clear those lines really are. But what happened was I worked in HarperCollins for a couple of years when I was in my 20s, and then I went freelance and began working as an editor and built up a background of editorial work, doing anything from structural editing to proofreading over the next 10 years or so. And in the meantime, I was always writing in the background as well. So having come to writing from that direction, I think I felt like I knew a lot about the editorial process, obviously. And I think that stood me in really good stead when I was working on my books, because I was able to switch seats very easily and go from thinking about it with my writing head and then looking at it with an editor's head and answering their questions, so that by the time I give my books in, I think it still works like that. Hopefully they're much more polished than they might be without that experience. So from that sense, it was very fortunate that I had that background. But what has surprised me, I guess, is the post-publication aspect of the book, you know, just the extent of the marketing and the extent that you get out there and you continually talk about the book. And that took me a while to get used to. I'm used to it now, but I don't think I had any idea what I was in for in terms of what you do after the book is published to help the book on its way.
So you were sort of, when you were editing, you're sort of going, okay, that's my bit done, and you sort of go on to the next one. Whereas with the writing side of things, when you sort of keep the book going for a lot longer, don't you?
Absolutely. And I never really worked in the marketing or publicity department. So even when I was working at HarperCollins, I was in the fiction department, and we did all the work on the actual text and the covers and one thing and another, and then we sent them on their way and you would see them out and about. But I don't think I'd thought through everything that you need to do to put that book into the world. So that's been a great learning curve for me. And I would say that I'm still on that learning curve, because everything changes so quickly nowadays as well. There's always more to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that was one of the things that surprised me as well. I mean, I'm now sort of working on the second one, and it's really changed my perspective, going, okay, well, I can see, you know, what the publisher is going to say about this, or what the editor is going to be looking for here. I was chastised for using too many semicolons. So I'm rationing the semicolons now. That's my current project.
Yeah. Well, every book is different, isn't it? And every book gets easier in those ways, because you know a bit more about what's going on. But I also feel like when you go back to the beginning, it feels like every book is just as much of a challenge as well. So you really do start with experience, and it helps. But in other ways, you're still starting with that fresh page the whole time and that mountain to climb. But that's one of the exciting things I find about writing, is that there's always new challenges.
Yeah, absolutely. It's never stationary, is it?
Absolutely.
So let's talk about plot, because obviously that's a massive driver for these, you know, for works in this genre. How do you work through a plot? Do you plan everything out beforehand? Do you sort of see how it goes and fly by the seat of your pants? Do you do a combination?
I do something slightly different, actually, which Meg McKinley, who's another WA author, she calls backstitching, which I'd never heard that term until I spoke to her about it a few years ago. And what that means is that I plot at the beginning, and I then let the story take off, and I don't plot right to the end. I generally have an idea about what's going to happen at the beginning and at the end, but there's a bit of an amorphous middle in there. And so I start writing and I just let it flow for as long as I can. And then when I run out, which can happen, sometimes it goes on for tens of thousands of words, and sometimes that will happen a bit faster. But when I run out, then I go back and I look at my original plot and my original plan, and I decide what ideas I've then developed that might stay in there and how that works into the plot. And I then put a bit more of that plan in place. And then as soon as I get inspiration to write again, I will leave that plan behind and I will write and let it flow for as long as I can. Because to me, that's a little bit where, if there's magic going to happen, that's where it's going to happen, is when you're in that flow state. And so if I get to that point, I like to just let the words go down and then go back and look at the plan and tidy up and sort it out in the, yeah, so I kind of do it in reverse.
No, well, it sounds very very organic. It sounds like a very sort of intuitive way to do things, I suppose, because sticking rigidly to a plan, you know, and going, oh no, I can't have my character do that because I didn't plan to do it, seems a bit self-defeating, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I just think as well that if you've got some kind of plan written down, I don't know if I could do it just as a fly by the seat of my pants without anything written down. I've always had some kind of structure, and I always develop an overall structure in the story as well to guide me, so I know how many parts or how many rough chapters I'm aiming for or how many voices I'm going to be telling it in and that kind of thing. And I set my stall out there quite early on, so I have a general framework in certain areas, but if you plan too much, I find that it just the story can fold in on itself and you just back yourself into corners and you can't let that flow come. And yeah, I do really enjoy writing in flow and just seeing what happens. And I am sometimes surprised by my characters as well. They do things that I'm not expecting when I'm in that flow, and often they stay in the book. That's a really exciting point for me, because when they start telling me the things, I think, oh, I'm really connected to them. So that my subconscious is developing them for me now. And my ideal scenario is to be at that point.
Excellent. Yeah, well, it's good to have that sort of stuff just appear, isn't it, when you're writing and you're in that zone and you go, oh, just where did that come from?
Yeah, it's so fun and it's so important as well, I think, because you want your story to have a beating heart. You don't want it to feel like a floppy, dead story that you're pushing and pushing all the time. And so I think if you're getting excited about those moments are happening, it's a really good clue that you're on the right track with the story. However, I don't want to underplay the importance of being able to just analyze the story as well and take it apart and go back and look at how it's working in a very cold structural fashion, because I don't think I could get to the end of the book without doing that either. I think it would lose its way and start to meander. And there are points where I need to tighten all those stitches to make sure that everything's working, repace it. I know when I wrote All That's Lost Between Us, there's a key point there where there's a revelation. And that revelation, I wrote it and I liked the way it was done. But the point that it came in the story, I played around with so much to try and get at the right point in the story. So the pacing was all there. And I couldn't have done that without having some kind of structure and plan. So for me, both are important as long as one element isn't holding the other element back.
No, that sounds very, very sensible, I think. speaking of the pacing of everything and how it all ties together, obviously suspense is really important in this genre. And in You Don't Know Me, it's a very suspenseful book. Things unfold at a pace that really keeps you, you know, hooked. I found that it was really hard to sort of, you know, stop at the end of a chapter because you're going, oh, hang on, really need to pick up where this is going. So how do you build suspense? What would you advise any budding crime writers who might be listening or interviewing you? How can you go about, you know, creating suspenseful atmosphere?
Well, in a structural sense, I think it's the sort of things that we were just talking about and being able to play with that build, because if you don't have the right pacing, your narrative starts to fall flat it was funny, I once edited a book which was a horror story, and it was beautifully written and I could not figure out what was wrong with it. I was doing a edit pre-sale to try and help them sell the book, and I knew that something was wrong with it, and I just couldn't figure out what was going wrong with it, because everything seemed to on paper work, but again the story just didn't feel like it was flowing. And eventually I realized that what they were doing was there was so much horror in it and so much action in it, there was no pause, and we were on a high the whole time and we didn't have that ebb and flow, and you couldn't sustain it. It deadened the impact of those moments that they were trying to push as peak moments, because there were so many of them. And I've never really come across that before, so it took me a while to figure out what was wrong, because their writing was fantastic. And I often think about that book when I'm trying to pace my own writing and remind myself there can be the ebbs as well as the flows, and they need to work together so that you are sending your book into the reader's mind and allowing them space to breathe in between building up the suspense. So that's where you play with the details of your characters or just little segues or anything that you can add in that just brings it down for a little bit and allows them to rest before you keep the suspense going. Because to actually create great suspense, you need those pauses as well. And so
it can't be 100% all the time.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think that the pacing has become really critical in the kind of suspense books that I do. So I look for that a lot. And then, of course, all the different elements of story come into play. So finding those characters that, you know, can, working with characters who are hiding things and build it using the right language to build those characters, that everything comes into play in the tone that you're looking for with suspense. So you're just pushing people to question what's going on the whole time without going too far. And it's a balance. It's a very delicate line to try to walk, and it's a challenge as a writer to walk that line well and to feel like you're getting it right.
Yeah, what it's kind of bringing to my mind at the moment is I'm thinking about music. I'm thinking about like dynamic. You know, if a song comes in and it starts at 100%, you know, someone comes in and woo, and it just goes like that the entire song. You're sort of not going anywhere, right? You want to have a chorus that lifts, and you want to have things that sort of that play around a bit with the dynamic.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think sometimes, particularly with beginning writers, they underestimate the power of the quiet moment.
Mm.
And, you know, that quiet moment is really as powerful as any of the dramatic moments.
Oh, sorry, everyone, my dog just knocked over a pot plant. I heard that noise.
I'm sure they can edit that out.
Yeah, no, we'll keep this in as a quiet moment. That'll be part of the dynamic. Okay, so as I went through at the start of the podcast, you internationally successful. You've had many, many best-selling novels. I would call you successful. I'm sure most people would. Do you feel successful? How do you define success?
I do feel successful to a degree. I think it's almost a surprise to me. I've done my whole writing career with two small children. So my girls are 6 and 10 now, but I started publishing books when I was pregnant. So the whole thing, looking at the 6 books now, it feels a bit of a blur, and I don't even think I've taken in everything that's happened yet, because there's still no time. You know, there's still lots of calls of mom going on in the background. I am very pleased, obviously, with how the books have done and that they have sold as well as they have and that they've gone international. The Hidden Hours is currently being developed for TV with a TV company in Australia, which is also really exciting, and I hope that goes the distance. Yeah. But having said that, I think the main reasons that the main way of personally judging success for me is very different. So there's two things. There's the first is creative joy, because I feel like if I lose that creative spark and joy, everything becomes very difficult. And in amidst all of the business of writing, it becomes quite challenging sometimes to keep that going and to make sure that you give space for that and to allow that to flourish. And I feel like I'm doing a good job if I have a good session of writing and I have a good writing routine and I can lose myself in the writing and I feel like I'm writing well, you know. So that's one definition of success for me. And I think the other way that I really do find meaning in what I'm doing is the reader feedback. So, and it's an email now and again that comes when something in your book has touched someone or meant something to someone and they've taken the time to tell you. And I get such a buzz out of having that connection. You know, when you're writing on your own, you're imagining this reader, and often you don't get to really talk to the readers, or it's all very surface in the way that you're talking about the books. But every now and again, there'll be something that is just a bit of a deeper level that's connected with somebody. And to realise that your story has made that connection into somebody's world, you can't beat that. And I very much enjoy those moments.
That'd be beautiful. I mean, as you said, you sort of have an imaginary reader, but to have that person sort of, you know, actually solidified and you know, speaking to you turns it into sort of like a two-way thing, doesn't it? It's not just not just casting a book out into the ether and hoping that people are enjoying it.
That's right, yeah. It just makes what you're doing much more engaging, powerful, meaningful, all of those things when you feel like there is a conversation going on. you know, out there about this book, and it's coming back to you every now and again.
That's great. Well, you've mentioned just there your daughters, and also I mentioned earlier that you're studying, so there'll be a lot of demands on your time. How do you go with that? Are you able to sort of put aside a specific amount of time each day, or do you just take it when you can? How does that work?
Well, it's fairly crazy at the moment, obviously, particularly right now with this whole social distancing. And so I did have some childcare help, which I don't anymore. And I was going and sometimes working away, which I can't at the moment. So I think that the juggle is real, really. And I have to constantly decide, how do I get to the next point? How do I get to the next point? And it's literally just looking at, what's my goal? So my goal at the moment is to finish the book that I'm working on, and I'm pretty close. I've probably got about 15,000 words left to do. And it's just, how do I get that done? And so it's intense conversations with my husband, who's also working full time, about where I can find, you know, little chunks of time that I can really get my head into the book. Because that's the difficulty right now, of course, is that it's very hard to get your head out of everything else and into the book.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's day by day at the moment.
I think it's hard for people to get their heads anywhere at the moment. It's a very sort of all-encompassing, you know, environment of reading the news and trying to stay, you know, trying to stay updated and everything. It's a strange time.
Absolutely.
We're obviously on a podcast now. A lot of people will be listening to podcasts when they're working from home, when they're in isolation. And there is a podcast, without giving too much away, that plays quite a prominent part in You Don't Know Me, your latest book. So what do you feel about podcasts? How do you interact with podcasts? I know that they're relatively sort of recent on the cultural scene, but for a lot of people they have changed things a lot. Do you listen to podcasts personally?
Yeah, I do more and more, actually. I'm really enjoying them. And I didn't get into podcasts immediately, but I'd already listened to a couple of cold crime podcasts when I started writing You Don't Know Me. So I decided to incorporate a podcast into my story, partly because it was so contemporary and partly because I thought it provided a really good way into the plot, because as well as telling the crime story in You Don't Know Me, I'm also telling a love story, which takes off at the beginning of the book. So that actually pauses the crime story and the crime trajectory. So I thought if I had the podcast in the beginning, it was a good way of getting in plot points as well while their love story is developing, without me having to interfere too much with what's going on with the characters.
Yeah, some good sort of separate exposition. It's funny reading about it when I was reading about it, because it's so familiar, I suppose, now. Like when you're describing the way the music, you know, the opening music comes in, and the way she ends episodes and everything. As you said, it's such a cultural phenomenon now that I'm thinking of The Teacher's Pet, and I'm thinking of, you know, all of these podcasts. I'm like, I can so vividly hear that. And it's quite funny to me, because I'm writing obviously close to 100 years ago now. So I'm looking at how common technologies are, you know, I'm going, okay, well, this was invented and brought in at this time. Would it have been widespread enough for me to have, for me to have my characters discuss it? And then you're kind of at the other end, you're sort of working with things that are, you know, just entering the consciousness now, which is really cool, I think.
Yeah, really contemporary stuff. So I have problems with things like CCTV, which just drives me crazy, because everywhere I try and take my characters, they've got CCTV. So at least you don't have that kind of problem. But that leads me on to, can you tell us a bit more about what you're working on next? I'd love to hear it.
So I'm continuing with one of the characters from the story. So the guy who does, I suppose, most of the investigating, sort of fulfills the kind of investigator function, who is a friar or a kind of traveling priest type character, and he's sort of just moves further south from the first book, which is set up near Geraldton, and it's basically, I don't know, it's the same type of cozy crime thing. You know, I really do like that that feel. I really like being in that world and in that era, I think, is really interesting as well. But it's going to be more fixed. The first one was quite, spread out geographically. They travel from Mullewa down to Fremantle and out to Donga and Port Denison and stuff. This one I'm going to try and fix it a little bit more and have a bit more sort of character-driven stuff instead of, romping around the place.
Fantastic.
So, yeah, it's a lot of fun. And as I said before, having now been through the editorial process once, I'm coming at it from a, I suppose a slightly more informed perspective about, you know, which things I need to think about and which things are less important and so on. So it's really interesting. We'll see how it goes, I suppose. It's still early stages.
Yeah, and do you plan turning these into a series? So you're going to keep going with this era and the fire?
I think I will. I'll go on as long as it's fun, I suppose, as long as I'm enjoying it. So if no one's enjoying the first one and after that, you know, it's not particularly fun for me to keep writing, I'm happy to go on to something else. You know, I'm not I've always written, as you were sort of saying earlier, I've always written even though it's not being sort of published or looked at. I've dabbled in many different things. So, I'll always be writing stories here or there or in different, you know, times and different genres and just kind of see what I enjoy, I suppose. It's the most important thing for me.
Great.
Yeah. You mentioned earlier that you've got one of your books is being adapted into a television series or might be adapted into a television series. But a lot of them have already been adapted to audiobooks. So how does it feel when you listen to an audiobook, when you're hearing your words, you know, read by someone else? Do you enjoy that? Is that something that you do often? Do you listen to audiobooks?
Well, I don't listen to my own very often, I have to say. I do find it quite bizarre listening to someone else read the stories because it's never exactly as I've heard them, you know, and I hear them very specifically. So, but in general, I enjoy listening to audiobooks. I have listened to a few novels, and I can do crime audiobooks quite well, but there are some novels I've found where I'm much more like to drift if I'm listening to audio. And if I want to appreciate the language in the books and actually appreciate them properly, I think it doesn't suit the more literary books or for me. I want to actually sit and look at the text, I've realised. So I'll listen to the pacier crime where I can, if I do drift, I can pick it back up again. But yeah, some of the other books I've decided perhaps I'd be better doing more non-fiction audio or just re-listening to books on audio that I love and listening for detail rather than listening for the first time.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I've had the same feeling, but I haven't been able to sort of articulate why, you know, some books feel like this works really well as an audio and other ones I'm going, oh, I really want this on a page.
It's interesting though, because there are certain things that there was a Sally Rooney book I listened to, and that one I felt worked really well as an audiobook. And again, I wouldn't have expected it to. But some of the others, I just find, the thing I can't concentrate on the text as much as I want to, the language as much as I want to. And so it's better to actually read them.
No, definitely. There's always going to be things that work better that way. That's the way they were sort of originally done. Let's talk about your study. So your field of academic sort of inquiry at the moment, dystopian fiction, and you're specifically focusing on maternal relationships, is that right?
I am, yes.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you get into that? What was it, the first group? Because obviously that's not the genre that you're writing in.
No, well, I was quite interested in a lot of dystopian fiction that was coming out when it was really big. So some of the YA stuff, the really obvious ones like Hunger Games, Divergent, I was just very curious as to why that was tapping into the young adult market so well. And then when I started reading some of them, I realised that they have a common theme, which is that the mother figure is often missing or dead or absented in some way. And the more I looked into this, the more it's supposed to be. It's kind of a trope of fiction where the parents are often out of the way to allow the children or the teenagers or the young girls in this case to have their own agency.
It's however, in Disney things, isn't it? I'm trying to remember. I remember someone saying, that Disney movies often have, you know, parents who are missing or deceased or something.
Absolutely. And so it does start in fairy tales. And as I've written a bit about that before, actually. But there's this constant sense that for the young person in the story, the young protagonist, to have their own sense of identity, the parents often go missing. And I wondered what would happen if you reconnected the mother into a story where it's the young girl who is the main protagonist. and whether you connect to that whole maternal line. So in fact, I've got the grandmother and the mother going on in my story, because I wanted to find out whether the young person could still have the same sense of agency, because I do wonder whether it's having this unintended effect as well, that we are disempowering the intergenerational relationships by doing that, because we never present present intergenerational relationships in that field. It's often missing. And whether we can do that successfully, or whether we can do that with the conflict. Some of the conflict has to be internal, because obviously you need conflict between characters, but also that where, so my characters are much more in conflict with the wider world as well as one another. And they're all very present for each other as well. So it's really a kind of experiment to see what happens. And it's been interesting. It's got mixed results. You know, it's not easy to do that. And I do find that often the mother takes over if I'm not careful. So it's fascinating to try and keep the daughter empowered when the mother is present.
It is. Yeah, it's an interesting one, isn't it? And
yeah, definitely.
And I suppose having those networks there as well, having, you know, having supportive, you know, loving parents and grandparents and things, you're right. I mean, it's a safety. there's a sort of safety in that, which is kind of not conducive to the crisis, isn't it? Or the actual sort of conflict that drives the plot.
Yeah. And also you can find that you're doing things for the sake of it, for the sake of your investigation, rather than because it makes good storytelling. So you can force them together, whereas really, you know, sometimes perhaps they should move apart for a while. And so it's a very interesting way of trying to tell a story. And it's definitely been a good experiment. I've learned a lot from it and learned a lot about narrative techniques. And even in terms of very simple sentence structure that can make such a powerful difference. So there's one scene where someone comes in to talk to the daughter. And at one stage I had the mother steps back to let this person in and to talk to them, and I changed it to the daughter steps forward, and it was literally a few words.
Okay.
And it made a massive difference to her presence in that scene, because instead of the mother stepping back to allow the daughter to speak, the daughter stepped forward to take her own place in that conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it's her
agency. Tiny little differences like that are so powerful. So I'm really enjoying it.
Oh wow! So there'll be a lot to look into there for your study, I suppose.
I think I'm going to have problems keeping the word limit down rather than the other.
And do you think that in general, when you talked about that sort of boom of dystopian fiction, do you think that in general everyone's, you know, feeling more apocalyptic at the moment, or more, you know, why do you think this has been happening lately? I mean, present, obviously the last few months have been an extreme representation of that. But even before that, I think a lot of people were focusing on sort of, you know, you had the doomsday preppers, and you've got a lot of, you know, more dystopian fiction and end of the world type scenarios. What do you think is going on there?
Well, I think we've had a sense of impending doom as society for a long, long time. And, you know, we're talking about like 1984 was like technological doom. You know, there's been lots of different types of doom coming along for us, but it's always been held at arm's length where we can look at it and examine it, and we're still in a position of relative safety at that stage. Right? I think what's happened in the last few months has taken that away completely. It's taken our safety net from us, and for now I'm re-examining what I've already written in this dystopian fiction and seeing it in quite a different light in the context of how will readers feel about this now when I present it to them, because it's not distant anymore, and what's now painful, and so I think it's going to throw up a lot of interesting questions around dystopian fiction. I know I've seen very different takes on looking at dystopian fiction now as well online. I've seen some people say they're reading it a lot, and other people say, you know, obviously they're staying away from it, they want comfort fiction. And but I think the key is that a lot of our future ideas have now become present realities in a very short space of time. So, you know, isolation, more of a police state, which obviously is essential in some ways in this pandemic, but how far you would go down that line is always going to have grey areas. There's so many different aspects which have suddenly been shoved right into our faces, and now we have to negotiate our way through this reality. And writing about the future now has become quite strange as well, you know, because now the doom is here. What's past that point? And, you know, climate change has gone completely into the background, hasn't it? Whereas Everything was about climate change a couple of months ago. So, yeah.
It's been very interesting to compare, I mean, what, you know, scientific communities have called, you know, a crisis for a long time with the with climate change. The response to that obviously was very, you know, has been very intermittent and very sort of slow in a lot of places. And then obviously this more immediate threat, you can see that people can, you know, can decide on change and people can implement change quite quickly if the will is there.
Absolutely. And it's going to be very interesting when we come out the other side of COVID, whether what happens with climate change, whether people are, you know, are more active in trying to get change happening and combat climate change, or whether there's this kind of sense of we're exhausted and we can't deal with another thing, particularly not one that's in our faces. Yeah, and, you know, we need time out from this, and whether then climate change groups can get traction in the same way. And it's going to be fascinating. And I'm, you know, constantly reading and very interested in what the general discussion is in the wide world about that.
It is fascinating. And sometimes I feel a bit, a bit like a gawker or something, because people will be going, oh, isn't this, you know, this is terrible, this new reality, you know, there's a lot of stuff to worry about. And I'm, and I am feeling that, of course, everyone's feeling stressed and concerned, but I'm also, like you said, I'm going, this is so interesting. Mm-hmm. And I feel a bit like I'm this strange sort of voyeur in my own world, just sort of going, wow, how, you know, the way that people are responding to this is really interesting.
I think that's got to be the writer's brain, hasn't it? Because we're constantly examining time to look at human nature and, you know, interaction and how, when everything changes, what happens. And so, yeah, I reckon that it's, in one way, it's food for writer's brain, but actually writing about it then is very challenging because, like you say, we're all watching the news and caught up with everything that's going on. So actually finding that mental space to gather your thoughts, I think, is going to be very difficult over the next little while.
It is very difficult, and that kind of brings me quite nearly to my next question, which is talking about writers in this time and people in creative professions generally, because of, you know, the vagaries of self-employment, reduced spending, you know, and cancellation of concerts and book launches and showings and things like that. So what do you think our role is at this time? Someone, you know, who is writing or creating creative work, what should we be doing, or, you know, how can we be how can we come to terms with this?
Yeah, well, it's hard to answer collectively. I think when I'm looking at what I am doing, I'm thinking, well, this is, again, a time to listen and learn as much as anything else, because everything is changing so quickly. Find out how to do meaningful work in the midst of it all, work that means something to you, while recognizing that what we can offer the world at the moment is entertainment and escapism and the chance to live in another world for a little while. And I don't think it's never been so important to have that chance at the moment. So the more we can help people to get involved in story and feel that they can have some form of release in relaxing into a story or just letting a story take them away, I think that storytelling is as pivotal as ever in this moment. And as a writer, I just want to make sure that whatever I've already got out there, you know, is there for whoever might find it. And then what I'm doing right now feels like I'm engaging with what's going on, but just doing meaningful work, but work that's also going to ultimately provide readers with some escapism as well.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the things that readers might enjoy. Let's do some recommendations. Love to read Local Week, as we said. So have you got some books you could recommend at the moment from West Australian authors, maybe in your genre?
Absolutely. Well, I can do a few escapism books first. I think that if you read anything by Natasha Lester, I mean, she's not actually in my genre, she's historical fiction, but her books are so beautiful, set obviously around World War II most of the time in New York and Paris. They will carry you away. I think that anything by Rachel Johns and Tess Woods as well is also just the kind of enjoyable, comforting read that you could really benefit from right now, or I could benefit from right now. And then, of course, crime. We've got fantastic Dervla McTiernan here, who's done the Cormac Riley novels. She's just got a new one out. We've got Dave Rich Wilson. If you like your crime local, every time I read something by David Wilson, I learn more about WA, as well as enjoying the crime story and marvelling at the way he can write.
Which is excellent, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. And then I'd also say, obviously, we've talked about dystopian. So AJ Betts is a young adult dystopian series. It's not just for young adults. It's the Rogue and Hive duology. That's another fantastic one. That's, I think, one of them was only recently published, and that's dystopian, but it's a beautifully told story. It's not going to get you down. It's just a really well-told vision of a society in the future, or alternative society.
What might happen?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So they would be my recommendations. What about you?
Fantastic. I struggle with this one because most of what I read in my genre is from, 100 or more years ago and is not particularly local. So, because I'm bad like that. I'm looking. So, come at me if anyone has some good recommendations, and I'll definitely be looking at the ones that you've just outlined there. But I do read, just in all sorts of genres. So, I really enjoyed Kim Scott's stuff. It was amazing. That Dead Man Dance was excellent. As you said, you mentioned David Wish Wilson, and I've just been reading The Coves, which I thought was fantastic. Yeah. Did you read that one?
Yes, I have read that one. It's brilliant. Mm. It? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, historically speaking, it was a really, really interesting, that was a very, very rich kind of, historical picture that you get led into. Yeah. And then short stories wise, I really enjoyed one that was from Nadine Brown, and I don't know how to pronounce her name. I'm sorry, I'm going to do it wrong because she's Romanian and I'm not, but I believe Mihaela Nicolescu, I hope. They had a collection called The Whip Hand, which I really, really liked. I grabbed in Freo last year, and it was just, there's a real range of amazing short stories in there that, they're like that, exactly what a short story should be, I suppose. They say so much more than what's actually there. They hint at these narratives that are just kind of intangible, just hanging there beyond the scope of the story. So I really love that one. And there we go. So much.
Yeah.
As we said, so many West Australian authors, illustrators, creators of all kinds to keep us going through this and all times ahead.
Absolutely. Yes, we're not short of a talent here in WA, that's for sure.
We certainly aren't. We're short of toilet paper, and we're short of, what else are we short of? Flour, but we're not short of talent.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. All right, well, it might be time to wrap it up. So I'll say thank you all for joining me for this special episode of Love to Read Local Radio. My name, again, is Alexander Thorpe, and very big thank you to Sarah Foster for joining us today. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks for having me.
No worries at all. Love to Read Local Radio is brought to you by Fremantle Press with support from the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. Love to Read Local is a celebration of West Australia's many, many wonderful writers and illustrators and the books they create. It's brought to you by Writing WA. You can check out the show notes from today at fremantlepress.com.au and look for more details about Writing WA. You Don't Know Me by Sarah Foster. Amazing book. It'll keep you going through this time. It can be ordered by phone or online from all good bookstores. For more information about my own book, Death Leaves the Station, go to fremantlepress.com.au, and as I said, that'll be out later this year. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Thank you. Goodbye.